But I'm ready if you are. Are we ready to? Let's begin by focusing on our breath. Breath flowing in, breath flowing out. Flowing in and flowing out. Deep in breath. The source for the teachings we discuss is the book The Living Gita by Satchidananda. I would like to read a little bit from the book today before we start. At the very beginning of the book, there's a quote from the Reverend Sri Swami Satchidananda. He says, "Scriptures ought to be read again and again. If any of the lines here catch your eye and your heart, read them often. Learn them by heart and apply them in your life. You don't even need a whole sentence, not even half a sentence. Just a quarter of one line is enough to lift you like a rocket, not just to the moon or Mars, but to the heavenly sun itself." There's a nice little summary of what the Bhagavad Gita is about from the foreword. The Bhagavad Gita tells the story of how Arjuna, the great warrior, warrior prince, the warrior king, is seated in his chariot about to engage in battle. As a metaphor for how we engage in life. When he sees his own kinsman and his revered teacher arrayed in battle against him, and he feels that he cannot fight. It is then that Krishna, the cosmic Lord, comes to counsel him. The interrelation of this is that Arjuna represents the human soul seated in the chariot of the body, and Krishna is the inner spirit, the God within, who is there to counsel him. Just as we heard today, let God and let go. The same thing. The commentaries in this volume were not written originally, but were spoken by the Reverend Sri Swami Satchidananda to his students. This has been the traditional method of imparting spiritual knowledge from guru to disciple since time immemorial. That is why his commentaries often have the character of conversation rather than something someone wrote. These works, the whole Veda, of which the Bhagavad Gita is part, are called in Sanskrit Shruti, Shruti, which means that which is heard, Shruti. The content of these Shrutis is called in India Sanatana Dharma, or eternal truth. These shrutis that you just heard are called Sanatana Dharma, or eternal truth. Even today in India, this philosophy is known simply as Sanatana Dharma, not as Hinduism. In India, what we think of as religion, they refer to as Sanatana Dharma, eternal truth. The word Hindu is incorrect. That label appeared only when foreigners came to India, saw a beautiful culture around the Indus Valley and the Indus River, and started calling the people of that area Hindu. Later it became Hindus.
In Hinduism, is that the basic scripture?
It's one of the basic scriptures. There's an epic story called the Mahabharata. Mahabharata, which I think is twice or three times as long as the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. It's a huge story with many characters interwoven. If you live in India, those characters are part of your cultural background. One particular part of the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, okay.
It's one book in a large compendium. And it is such a concise exposition of the basis of the religious tradition there that it is used in a way like a Bible, like we use a Bible. We don't use the whole Bible to teach us how to behave. The Bible is like the Mahabharata in some way. It's full of stories about who begat whom and so on, in addition to the precepts for our moral behavior.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, here we go. Satchidananda, a path for personal spiritual transformation. Our subject is his commentary in the Bhagavad Gita. Our primary focus will be on verses with practical spiritual advice. I have a bit of a summary of what we've covered so far, and then we can begin where we left off. Summary or begin where we left off? I have about four or five verses which summarize.
Yeah, I'll go for
summary. Summary's good after a bit of a hiatus. We're going to look at chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Yoga of Wisdom. The Yoga of Wisdom.
What does yoga mean in this context?
That's a good question. Chapter 2, the Yoga of Wisdom. What we are studying here is yoga. The translation of yoga, which is a Sanskrit word, into English would be unity. Unity. We have a word in English called yoke, which unifies animals to the plow. Unity. In unity here, it's my observation that we often don't understand the word unity as the deeper meaning. We talk about unity people as opposed to others. We're unity people.
Yeah, we do that.
And there's others. It's a natural thing to do. When we think of unity, we think of people who subscribe to the unity principles. In a deeper sense, if we dig a little deeper, unity is the union of ourselves with the divine, to experience the unification of ourselves with the divine, to experience that it is not me or my who is doing things, rather it is my nature, my God-given nature, that is doing things. The only proper role I have is as an observer of my actions. And I also have the will characteristic to let go and let God, turn it over to God, and to be the observer of my union with the divine, so that when I look outside and I think of God as being omniscient. I didn't pronounce that word.
Omniscient.
And omnipresent and omnipowerful, right, and so on. That is all I see is the divine. And by beginning to see those things outside ourselves, we can train ourselves to observe that in others as well. And then we can also train ourselves to look inside and see that inside. So our unity, or yoga, union of the divine. So unity, union with the divine, is what the Bhagavad Gita, that's the eternal truth. And chapter 2 discusses the wisdom or intellectual aspect of it. There's various aspects of our union with the divine. One is our intellectual aspect of wisdom. There are other aspects, which we'll get to in other chapters. So, great question. What is yoga? It's not just the Hatha postures as interpreted here in the West. Rather, it is union with the divine. We're going to run through 5 slokas here. 5. So here's Arjuna in his chariot, despondent. It would be better for me to live as a beggar than to kill these great souls who have been my teachers. Even if I were to kill them, my enjoyment of wealth and desires in this world would be stained with their blood. Here's Arjuna facing a crisis, big crisis. There's 2 groups, the good guys, of which he is the leader, and the bad guys, who are his kinsmen, his relatives. And he's put in the place of having to fight against them, and he intellectualizes and says, no, this is not a good idea. The story starts off like this to illustrate the difference between figuring out what to do and letting go and letting God. He's now figuring out what to do, isn't he? The sons of Dhritarashtra, those are the bad guys, the sons of Dhritarashtra stand before us. I do not know which would be better, for us to kill them or them to kill us. If we slay them, we won't even want to live. This is an extreme example of rationalization. I am weighed down with weak-mindedness. Well, at least now he's starting to observe himself, isn't he? This is the transformation. I am weighed down with weak-mindedness. So he's not in the state of, well, I'm right. Wrong, I know what to do. Rather, he says, I'm noticing, I am weighed down with weak-mindedness. I am confused and cannot understand my duty. I beg of you to say for sure what is right for me to do. I am your disciple. Please teach me, for I have taken refuge in you. In summary, I am letting go and letting God. Which now sets the stage for these teachings. We studied some of the teachings that came after this. The first verse is, the wise grieve neither for the living nor the dead. The wise grieve neither for the living nor the dead. I had to take this particular verse under great repetition for it to make sense to me. It's one of those verses that didn't go clunk for me. I tried to explain it even here. Didn't go clunk for me. even though I had a wonderful explanation from Satchitananda. It's an example of how, at least for me, I have to go back to these verses again and again until the underlying truth sinks in. We're not going to discuss that one again today. We're going to go on to some other ones. Okay? So this is 5 through 7. Now we're going to pop way up to 37, right in the middle. Any questions before we do that? If you are killed, you will go to heaven. If you are victorious, you will reign on earth. And therefore, rise up, Arjuna, resolve to fight. We ended at sloka 7, where he says, I don't know what to do. Now, here we are at 37. He's still telling Arjuna what to do. If you are killed, you will go to heaven. If you are victorious, you will reign on earth. Therefore, rise up, Arjuna, resolve to fight. Some people think that the Bhagavad Gita is a recommendation for violence and war. Other people think that it's a metaphor, Gandhi in particular, and rather represents just our following what is ours to do. You can make your own decisions about that. Perhaps at that time, if you were a warrior, what was yours to do was to fight. And we'll see here, the key message is, can we rely on some other aspect of ourselves than figuring it out to make good decisions? It reminds me of when I decided to get married for the first time. And I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what to do. I had some recommendations from some friends. And of course, I was full of lust and desire and so on, which was a strong motivator. And I remember the day and the street and the place where I figured it out what to do. And what I figured out was, well, this person has this quality and that quality. Her parents are like this, my parents are like that, and she's this and she's that and so on. Therefore, I will marry her. And then I remember on our honeymoon, now this may be true, most people I don't know. We were in the first stage of our honeymoon, we were sitting on some steps in Greece actually, and she wanted to go to a party and I wanted to go read a book, or something like that.
Ooh.
Or a museum.
Big and difference.
Yes!
And I thought to myself, what have I done?
Right. Click.
What have I done?
Dropped to the heart. The wisdom kicked in.
What have I done? And there was another person, a young woman who I did love, had love for a long time, but never told her, of course. I'm a man. Men don't do that. If you tell someone you love them, it means you have to marry them.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of fun things to do before I got married. So I lost touch with that other woman. She led a different life. But that's what came to me. And of course, I had never told that woman how I felt. The truth is, as a young man, I wasn't even sure how I felt because I didn't have the skills to look down and see what was mine to do. So here's Arjuna figuring things out, but he's lucky to have that soul advisor that I hadn't found. And his advisor said, if you're killed, you go to heaven. Big deal. If you're victorious, you'll reign on earth. Big deal. Therefore, rise up, resolve to do what is yours to do. You with?
Mm-hmm.
There's Satchitananda's commentary. But when I say arise and fight, don't forget that you are acting on my behalf, not for your own sake. See the difference? It's not the I doing it. Everything we do is on behalf of our divine essence. Can we be in touch with that? You have been created for this purpose in my cosmic plan on my behalf. And you are only fulfilling that purpose. Personally, you don't have anything to do with these things. It's like the second or third agreement? Don't take anything personally. Yes?
Second agreement.
Second agreement.
Because words I'm trying to live by.
Yeah, don't take anything personally. Same thing. Personally, you don't have anything to do with these things. Your job is to see what is yours to do, which is sometimes called your duty. That's just what's yours to do.
That's a hard thing to figure out, though. You know, where is that coming from? What is yours to do? And it's because somebody else wants you to do it, or because you think it's the moral thing to do, or if somehow or another you can get in touch with something deeper that tells you really what's to do. How can you listen to the right thing?
Yes. When you say it's a hard thing to do, I can empathize with you. Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to do, when I hear you say that, comes from our mind trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And our lack of willingness to have patience and wait for guidance. We read ancient histories about rulers have to make a big decision and wait for a sign. And one day a crow flies over. He said, that's the sign. Now we'll go to war, or we won't go to war. Makes a decision. And I recalled that when thinking about these teachings. Signs are very important. I used to think, no, I think, that's all gobbledygook, you know, people depending on superstition to make decisions rather than smart people like me who can figure everything out, being unwilling to realize that the most important thing to know is, I don't know. The most important thing to keep in mind, I don't know. Not really. I can figure things out, but I don't know. So if we rely on God, and if we have the patience to let go and let God, I think it's perfectly appropriate to wait for a sign. Not that the sign means anything in itself. It's just somehow that sign opens up within us. What is our duty? What is ours to do? It reminds us. We see through our intellect trying to figure everything out, and we get clarity. And other people may say, that foolish man, he's going to go to war because the crow flew from north to south. They missed it. Somehow that crow reminded the ruler of what was his to do. And in the case of Arjuna, what was his to do was to fight. That was his duty. And the Bhagavad Gita has to do with his inability to see that and what steps to take to learn how to get in touch with his yoga, his unity, his divine union. Now, Lord Krishna begins speaking about the path of karma yoga. In yoga, which is this divine union, over time there develop different disciplines to achieve this experiences of the divine. Karma yoga is what we do. And there's a whole practice of yoga revolved around doing things, being active to experience the divine union, using our activities to experience divine union, dedicating what we do, what we eat, each breath, our defecation, our sight, everything, devoting it to God, the divine. What we do, that's karma yoga. There are other branches of yoga. Bhakti yoga is the yoga of wisdom, using intellectual pursuits to develop experience of divine union. And there are others as well. So karma yoga is doing. That's what. And by the way, all these different branches of yoga, they all collapse into one. Each one supports the other. Now we'll look at the next two chapters after 37, number 38 and 39. Seeing the same in pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat, prepare yourself for the battle and do not succumb to sin. Sin here is figuring it out, which can lead to missing the mark.
Interesting, it's called sin.
Called it sin. Well, this is a translation.
Yeah.
Seeing the same, now this is a challenge, a mighty challenge for us to undertake. We perhaps need to memorize this particular sloka and refer to it frequently to get the benefit of it. Seeing the same in pleasure and pain. My wife's in great pain right now. How do I see the same in that pain as I do in when she's full of pleasure? And I'm in pleasure, because when she's in pain, I'm in pain. Seeing the same in pleasure and pain. Where is that place where one can see the same in pleasure and pain? It's easy enough to say the words. Where is the place inside us where we can see the same in pleasure and pain? Gain and loss. I was so happy the stock market was going up, 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 up. I was getting richer and richer and richer and richer. Now the stock market went way down. I'm getting poorer and poorer and poorer. Not really. Seeing the same in gain and loss, victory and defeat. I remember the end of World War II. Everybody was in the streets. They were all dancing. I was out driving with my aunt and uncle. I was a 5-year-old child. We were going to the ball game. I love ball games. And all of a sudden, we couldn't drive any further because the streets were filled with people and were all dancing and singing and cars weren't moving because it was the end of World War II and we were victorious. I don't think the Japanese and the Germans were seeing it the same way. They were in a state of defeat. How to retain that centeredness in victory and defeat so that no external circumstances jar us or throw us off kilter. Prepare yourself to do what is yours to do. Prepare yourself for the battle and do not succumb to sin, which is not following your inner guidance. A commentary now. The cause is just. Why was the cause just? Well, they made the story so that it would be just. They constructed it. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. There was no moral ambiguity whatsoever in this story. In real life, of course, there's always ambiguity. The people we call enemies or terrorists or enemy combatants, seen from other perspectives, could be celebrants at a wedding or a funeral, or fighters protecting the homeland, trying to evict the invader. So in real life, things are ambiguous. To see what is just, we're not going to be able to figure it out. If we rely on what the newspapers tell us, what commentators tell us, what our family thinks, what we've led to believe, we may not really get to the bottom of it. To know what is just, we have to look someplace else. And the Lord is saying, in this case, the cause is just. I'm here to tell you. I'm your inner voice. This cause is just. You are simply acting as an agent. Acting as an agent. So whatever the outcome may be, it's not going to affect you. We think of these poor soldiers with PTSD who come home, not sure that what they did was right or just, and wondering if their rationale for having figured out what they were doing really spoke from their heart. I remember watching the Vietnam story by Ken Burns. A man killed a person, the first person he killed in Vietnam. He was devastated. He was devastated. He killed a person. Devastated. It was totally against all his upbringing, his morals, and yet he was going to be thrust in that situation again. He rationalized it by calling the people who are out there gooks. Gooks. Call them gooks. And you don't even kill gooks. You just take them out.
Yes, what?
You don't kill gooks, you take them out. Mm-hmm. He took out a couple of gooks today. And through his rationalization, he removed himself from what his heart had felt. So perhaps for him, what he was doing, the cause was not just. But if the cause is just, then you are simply acting as an agent. So whatever the outcome may be, it's not going to affect you. You're doing what is yours to do, which in some cases may be killing. Depends on the consciousness. 39. You have been given the ideal of self-knowledge. He was talking before about self-knowledge. Now hear the practical wisdom of yoga, how to attain divine union. Now hear the practical wisdom of yoga, by which, Arjuna, you can break through all the bonds of karma. Karma is just what you do. Karma has various meanings, but in this case, karma is what you do. What did you do yesterday? What are you doing now? That's karma. And in some cases, what you do can entrap you and bind you. So now, hear the practical wisdom of yoga, by which you can break through all bonds of karma. Here's his commentary. In chapter 2 of the Gita, there are two sections. Samkhya, the theoretical part, and yoga, the practical part. Here, yoga is being used to represent karma yoga, I believe, the practical part. Merely knowing the theory is not enough. We have to put it into action. It's our fifth unity principle, isn't it? Put your belief into action. Same thing in the Bhagavad Gita. Some people sit and inquire about the Atman. The Atman is our soul, our inner self. Kapilas self. Some people simply sit and inquire about the Atman. Who am I? I am Brahman. The translation of Brahman is absolute one, essential one.
Is Krishna talking here?
Saying this is Satchidananda talking. This is Satchidananda's commentary on the verse. You're not with me, are you?
No, I do understand that, but who am I? I am Brahman. Who is he talking about being who am I?
Here's the verse, right? And here's Satchidananda's commentary. There are two sections, the theoretical part, the practical part, knowing the theory is not enough, action, okay, here we go.
Okay.
Some people, this is Satchidananda talking, some people simply sit and talk about it, and here's what some people might say, for example.
Thank you, we're talking about the Atman.
So Satchidananda is pretending to be somebody out there talking about it. Who am I?
Okay.
I am God. I am the divine essence, the absolute one. Some people may think and may even experience it in their thoughts. I am that. This is an appropriate thing to do. It's a great challenge to be able to come to that experience of being in a state of yoga, divine union. However, this is sheer jhana yoga, the path of discriminating wisdom. So these branches of yoga, jhana yoga, wisdom, and karma yoga is what we do. Others plunge into activity even without knowing the basic principles. There should be a beautiful harmony between theory and practice. Then life is more enjoyable and fruitful. You apply the theory in your day-to-day activities. It's basically putting feet to your prayers. So there's two aspects for us. One is to sit and meditate, but not all the time, and hide away in a cave, experience our state of yoga, divine union. And the other is to put it in practice, which is a karma yoga aspect. Some people say, probably it's too late for me now. I don't know how long I will live to practice these things. I don't have much time, some might say. Or I'm too old to do all this. I've wasted my life. He's imagining people hearing these words and their mind kicking in with reactive thoughts. But the Lord gives confidence to each and every one of us, no matter what we thought about ourselves. We might think, oh, this is too hard. Oh, I tried this. It's much too hard. I tried it and it didn't work. We all have these thoughts. I wish I could be that way.
We only have the moment anyhow.
Pardon?
All of us only have the moment.
It's all in the moment, isn't it?
And no matter how old we are.
All in the moment. It's not our past failures or successes.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have the future yet.
It's not our future hopes or worries. It's about right now. And that's why he says the Lord gives confidence to such people. Let's go on to the next verse. Number 40. In these practices, no effort is lost, nor are there adverse effects. Even a little practice of this Dharma protects one from great fear. Think of Dharma here as what is ours to do. Dharma has these different meanings, a religion, what is ours to do, what is given to me to do. Protects one from great fear, even a little bit, as you point out, in the moment, rather than focusing on the past or what's to come. Here's his commentary on that. The great advantage of yoga practice with an understanding of theory and principle, even a little practice won't be wasted. I will never cause adverse effect. So rather than focus on the past or the future, the recommendation is now, in this moment, take a breath. Ask yourself, who's breathing? You could ask yourself, God, breathe me. And then notice who's breathing you. Are you breathing you? You weren't paying any attention to it. You had nothing to do with it. Who's breathing you? God is breathing you. And you consciously give your breath over to God. Thank you, God, for breathing me. I'm so grateful for my breath. Oh, there comes another one. Thank you, God. You just keep it up. God's doing all these things. I'm so grateful. The great advantage is, as we understand theory and principle, even a little practice like we did just now won't be wasted. It will never cause adverse effects. Suppose you construct a house. Here he is talking to people, now he's going to elaborate with a story. You build up the walls and then say, I've spent all my money, I don't have enough to put on the roof. He loves stories like this. All the energy you use to build the walls is wasted. It's the same way with all worldly things. See, we relate spiritual practices to worldly things. It's like my daughter on the phone yesterday says, Dad, I spent all this money on these car payments, $7,000 of car payments, and I don't want it to go to waste because what I did in the past, I need some help on a payment this month. And I said, but this car has fallen into really bad shape. It has so many things wrong with it. It's probably not worth more than $500 to $600. So with worldly things, it's like that. He goes on. If you begin, you have to go to the very end to get the benefit in worldly things. But the practice of yoga, it's different. Even if you practice hatha yoga, postures and breathing, pranayama, for one day. That practice we did just now is called pranayama in the practice of yoga, breathing. There are other breathing practices you can do to experience your breath. There's a whole science of it. It's very interesting. Pranayama. Even if you practice postures and breathing for one day or a few minutes, at least you'll be relaxed on that day, won't you? Which is what counts. It's like eating. Even if you eat on just one day, it will take care of that day. It won't go to waste. So that's what spiritual practices are like. That's why Lord Krishna says that even a little bit is good. Try it. If you like it, take more. No bad after effects like poisonous drugs. At least no effects. Here's the last sloka for today, number 41. If your mind is unsteady and wandering, many branched and endless are the thoughts and choices. When your mind is clear and one-pointed, there is only one decision. You remember when I was recounting the story of how I decided to get married? My mind was wandering here. There wasn't very steady. I was trying to figure it out. This happens to us a lot. in two ways. One, when we are consciously trying to make a decision, let's see, should I buy that dress, that car, go with this guy, person, get up or stay in bed, our minds are sometimes unsteady and wandering. Also, that's when we're consciously trying to make a decision. When we're not necessarily involved in deciding something, we're just alive, we're distracted often by our minds, aren't we? Oh, I shouldn't have done that. What if I do this? I'm kind of worried about that. I wonder how Janice is doing at home. I'm not thinking about that, but I could be. And I wonder how people are, blah, 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 blah. So the practice of yoga is to help us in two things. If your mind is unsteady and wandering, many branch and endless are the thoughts and choices. When your mind is clear and one-pointed, there's only one decision. How do we keep our mind clear and one-pointed? In the case of having a decision to make, there are certain practices we can do. And we talked about that. Being patient, being willing to look for the inner guidance, perhaps looking for signs, so that when the guidance comes, we just know, without trying. Our mind may still be wandering in the process. You know, the mind has a mind of its own. But even so, while the mind is wandering, something may just show up for us. Ah, without effort or trying, this feels right. And our mind may fight back and say, oh, you stupid person. People will think you're silly if you do that. People are going to call you stupid if you do that. Your mind may fight back, but somehow you just know. So, do you have the spiritual steadiness to listen to what comes up for you to do and be willing to put up with other people's opinions and even your old opinion of yourself? Do what is yours. Now, in the case of the mind just wandering around and not being very useful, getting you in trouble, worrying about this, grieving about that, there are other yoga practices. Do you have an idea what they might be?
Practices in the moment or practices that you do?
Let's say your mind is just wandering around. You're sitting here and all of a sudden something comes up. You're worried about the taxes, got a concern about the kid. And this is not a useful activity your mind is doing. It's a reactive thing. What are some yoga practices to steady your mind and keep it one pointed and clear?
I know. What I do is when I notice that I'm just going off the deep end somehow, you know, like that, I just go back to my breath, mm-hmm. even in the moment, anywhere, anytime.
Very good.
I just calm that, and that just sort of centers me.
There's a wonderful yoga practice to focus on the breath. Notice the breath going in, notice the breath going out. You might even have a little saying that goes along with it. Different things work for different people. I have a little saying that I use when I want to focus on the breath. I have several sayings, actually. Sometimes I'll just do Om Shanti. I'll use that one. Sometimes I'll use breathing in. I calm my body. Breathing out. I smile. Dwelling in the present moment, I know it's a wonderful moment. Those are examples of some practices we can use to practice keeping our mind clear and one-pointed. If we choose to practice the practices, especially when things aren't too disruptive in our lives. When things are disruptive, our reactive minds, they are strong. And unless we've put these practices into our consciousness, like training for going into the Olympics, they're not going to be there to support us so much when we could use them. And even as I experience sometimes when I use my practices to calm the thing in my mind, the reactive experiences that are in me somehow keep trying to come back in my consciousness. Very interesting.
But you're right. I mean, I find the more that I meditate, the more that I practice, it has helped me. It makes it easier to go back to that point when things are really chaotic around me. I'm finding that I have more capacity now to be less reactive.
Yes.
And it used to happen all the time, no, but it's an improvement. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I'll take any improvement.
I notice the same thing. If I miss my morning meditative walk, sometimes I'm a little off kilter during the day. And if I have that morning meditative walk, when something comes up during the day, I can go back to that meditative state I was in and have it support me when the reactive things come up. Same thing. If your mind is unsteady and wandering, so we have to notice that first. If we're unaware of that, if we think this is just normality, we're not going to notice it. If your mind is unsteady and wandering, many-branched and endless are the thoughts and choices. And sometimes, by the way, I found out when my mind is wandering, it actually has something useful to do. I've noticed that too. I'll be walking along and my mind will go off on the subject and I'll start to bring it back. And then I notice my mind has something useful to figure out, and it figures out something that I need to do. Usually some technical computer problem that I've been grappling with. And my mind figures out something, and I say, thank you. So it wasn't just wandering, it had a purpose. Different situations come up. Can we discern which is which?
Well, those are the times when the answers come to you, I think, you know, that you've been fretting about when you're quiet and contemplating and meditating, an answer to something else previous comes to you.
Yeah, I think I'm trusting more that there are so many parts to my mind that I'm not privy to. So much is going on in there. The more that I'm quiet, it almost, you know, the more centered I am, it's like those parts are still working. And so, like you said, you know, I think that's. And then I'm quiet, and then all of a sudden an answer pops up. It's because it's been working somewhere.
Yes.
And I've been out of touch with it. But just by being quiet allows it to surface.
And your mind just wants to tell you about it.
I know.
So you'll know.
Yes, absolutely. Wants to take control again.
When your mind is clear in one pointer, there's only one decision. Here's his commentary. Krishna addresses Arjuna about the difference between people of firm and infirm mind. If you have an infirm mind, where do you go? The infirmary. It's very simple, he says. Of course, things are never quite so simple.
No.
But yet it is simple. The amazing thing, it seems hard, but in reality, when you look back, it's simple. It just seemed hard. It's very simple. For the firm mind, there's only one decision. But for the infirm mind, many branched and endless are the decisions. To reap the harvest, a farmer needs a firm mind with one conviction. Here's the story now. By doing such and such, I will harvest this much. With such conviction, he does everything towards fulfillment. What is the farming he's recommending? Our spiritual practices. With such conviction, in farming in this case, he does everything towards fulfillment. A good farmer never changes midway. He doesn't prepare the soil and sow the seeds somewhere else. Our spiritual practices. No, he will sow the seed and then say, nor will he sow the seed and then say, I don't have time to take care of it. I don't have time to meditate. I don't have time to do this or that. I don't have time. He continuously uses his effort until he reaches his goal. That is what is meant by a firm mind. It could also be called a resolute mind. Mm-hmm. Resolute. What am I resolved to do here? Firm mind. Any questions or closing comments or observations before we close?
This is part of the, what is it called, the perennial, is it perennial-like truth that is in so many of the, that is in major faiths and religions that he's speaking of?
Yes, this same teaching is in all the
yeah. This
major faith that underlies everyone. As Satchitananda points out, truth is one, paths are many,
right.
Whether it's Hinduism or the Dharma, Santara,
Christianity,
Islam,
Judaism,
yes. Truth is one, paths are many. Well, I'm grateful to be here today. That's my.
Yeah. We are grateful that you're here.
It's nice
to be
back.
Yeah.
As we do a little pranayama, breathing in, breathing out. Thank you, God, for the breath. And with a deep in breath. Shanti. And go in peace.